This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Obesity among children 6 to 11 years old has increased 382% since 1974. In children 12 to 19 years old, it has increased 258% since 1974. At the same time, no states prohibit sales of junk food on an a la carte basis. Channel One, marketing to 5.7 million children a day in 12,000 schools, including ads for Hostess, Twinkies, Pepsi, Mountain Dew, M&Ms, and Snickers bars. 20% of schools sell high-fat fast foods like Pizza Hut and McDonald's. The majority of K-12 schools in the United States, 93.6%, allow the sale of soft drinks and other high-sugar-added drinks in vending machines. This is a big change from pre-1974 when typically schools sold nothing. So the Farm Bill is now working its way through Congress, and the junk food industry is looking at, we would like to be able to make sure that our products are still sold in schools. The schools are saying, no, don't think it's a good idea. Nutritionists talking back. The whole thing is starting to get very political. And Sam Kasman, the general counsel for the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the leader of their CEI's Death by Regulation project, on the line with us, CEI.org, the Competitive Enterprise Institute's website. Hey, Sam, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Now, tell me why we the people should not say to the schools that we fund collectively, sorry, you can't sell poison to our kids anymore.
Because this is not a federal issue. You know, I can see school districts having debates over these policies. I can even understand states doing it at that level. But the notion that the federal government ought to be doing this attempt, and now these are their words, this attempt to protect the integrity of school lunches by banning the sales of all these listed items from school vending machines strikes me as way out of line. You know, the actual bill here, what the Harkin is pushing, is called the School Lunch Protection Act. You know, and it's like, you know, protecting school lunches all of a sudden takes its place up there with homeland protection. I just don't see this as a federal function.
Well, there's two things that tie it to the federal function. The first is that an awful lot of school lunches are going to poor kids. One in six children in America lives in poverty. I mean, that's a mind-boggling statistic to begin with, but it's real. And so you've got, you know, one in six children living in poverty, they are eligible for federally funded school lunches. Are those school lunches going to include Snickers bars, or are they going to include fruit?
Well, that issue has already been decided. Namely, they can't include Snickers bars. The question now is, if a school wants to be reimbursed for these school lunches, it would also essentially have to drag all the Snickers bars out of any vending machines located on its property if those vending machines are open between the time of a school breakfast and 2 hours after the school
lunch.
Which
seems like a fine thing to me, Sam. I mean, here's the reality. Let's look at the bigger picture here for just a second, if I may.
The bigger picture is, at a certain point, they're going to do this, and kids are not going to get any healthier, and so they'll decide, well, look, you know, we have all these rules as to what can be sold in schools regarding food, but what are kids bringing in their school lunch bags from home? And so let's start checking them at the door when they enter the school in the first place.
No, you're...
Why not?
It's the Nazi schools. The reality, no, that's not the issue here, Sam. The issue here is that conservatives like you, no offense, have been putting into place all across the United States ballot initiatives and programs. For example, here in Oregon, it takes a super majority of the legislature to increase taxes. And yet at the same time, a conservative group funded from out of state, oddly enough, put into place this thing where if the state projects a budget surplus and, you know, 2 months out, or 2 years out rather, and they've got a surplus that they have to mail that back. I just got a check back. They call it the kicker here in Oregon. They have to mail that back to people. So what it is a slow death by strangulation of government. It's the Grover Norquist plan, and you've got schools all, and variations on this that are happening all over the country where schools are simply not being funded. They don't have enough money. And so in desperation, they're turning to these purveyors of poison who are saying, yeah, we'll give you a little percentage of the Snickers bar. You know, not to pick on Snickers. I like Snickers bars, actually. But
poison.
Well, but you see, poison. I think that, you know, as a regular dietary staple for kids, yeah, I think that even the more responsible candy companies would acknowledge that they're not, you know, a high nutrition product.
Right. I think they're a fine snack. If they'd been available in my middle school when I was in junior high, I would have loved it.
But they weren't. And your peers were not obese. And they are now. And our children's peers or our grandchildren's peers, depending on how old we are getting obese.
And I would bet you that you can ban them within a 10-mile radius of schools, and you're not going to change those obesity statistics one whit.
How do you know? How do you know? When obesity went up, when this stuff came into our schools, how do you know that taking them out of our schools is going
to
make it go down?
You know, there have been these studies, you know, what do school nutrition programs accomplish? And the basic answer is zero. They simply have no effect. I just don't. Now, look, I think individual families, you know, no question about that. And I think it's school districts and maybe even states. But once again, the notion that this is a federal function to somehow protect the integrity of school lunches by making sure nothing else is sold within that same time and place neighborhood, it's insane. And there is no reason why they would not extend it to checking school lunch bags when kids come in, because in some areas kids have already started hawking Snickers bars during recess that they bring from home because you can't any longer get it.
But this is about the schools endorsing a product, Sam. We're talking with, by the way, with Sam Kasman. He's the general counsel for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Sam, the one area where probably I would agree with you on this, on this whole thing, you know, again, stepping back and looking at the big picture, is that what you and I are arguing about right now, or debating, or whatever you want to call it, is essentially the symptom, not the problem. Now, you're suggesting that the problem is, you know, too much or too much regulation or the attempt here thereof. I'm suggesting that the problem is that our schools are in an absolute crisis right now because people who hate schools or hate big government programs or, in particular, hate unionized teachers have been strangling our schools, and so they're having to make a deal with essentially, you know, to use the metaphor, a deal with the devil to bring junk food into their schools simply as a way of getting money.
Well, look, if you're talking about the devil, remember the item that the devil offered to Eve in the Garden of Eden was this very nutritious apple. But that's a cheap shot. I agree. That's a cheap shot.
But I mean, you know, you have to grant me the reality that our schools that were, you know, the envy of the world in the 1950s and 60s and 70s have become you know, the tragedy of the world in the 80s, 90s, and this last decade.
Yeah, but I don't
think
it's because of the presence of vending machines or whatever is in.
No, it's because conservatives have been ripping funding apart.
You know, but I don't think they're looking to vending machines for salvation. But let me give you another point that I bet you and I agree on. In this agricultural bill, there's also a provision that no state can impose stricter standards on vending machine sales than what the feds imposed through the bill. And the reason that's there is because all these big companies in the snack food business said, okay, we're going to go along with the federal restrictions as long as you, the feds, protect us from even worse restrictions at the state level.
Right,
and once again, you know, I this is something I would take the feds out of entirely and leave this up to a state-by-state or even more local-by-local region issue.
Yeah, you're right. I do agree with you on that, and I think it speaks right to the Ninth and Tenth Amendments of the Constitution,
okay, so
frankly.
We're 2-0 on points we agree.
Okay, but the bottom line is that the you know, big candy, I don't know what else to call it, but is it big agro or the, you know, the big food companies, the big processed food companies are hell bent for leather to get this thing out of this farm bill that would prevent schools from having vending machines selling, you know, candy and soda pop to kids. And I other than perhaps trying to protect the interests of big business, I don't see why you would not be in favor of protecting our kids from, I mean, the lifelong dangers of obesity are serious stuff, Sam.
Yeah, but look how this school lunch program started. It began with a, you know, pretty legitimate claim that there are a number of kids coming to school too poor to eat properly. Let's feed them so they can learn properly. And then from then it goes to the notion that, well, we've got to control just what is being put on that cafeteria line to make sure that we're not subsidizing junk.
But as you pointed out, we're not talking about the school lunch program. We're talking about the vending machines.
It's going even further, saying we got to protect the integrity of the school lunch by casting an even wider net. You know, I think that's ridiculous.
No, this isn't about the school lunch. This is about schools selling products to kids and therefore implicitly endorsing them that are not good for those kids.
But the bill itself is called the School Lunch Protection Act, even though it's got to do, it deals with vending machines. And
well, it's, you know, the Clear Sky Initiative doesn't have much to do with clear skies either. I think here's the third point we can agree on. Legislation isn't always appropriately named. Sam Kasman, he's the General Counsel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. You can read all about it there. Thank you, Sam, for being with us.
Bon appetit.
You too. Good talking to you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
I can always ask for more, and they call me Mr. Natural. On down to the health food store, I only eat good sea salt, white sugar don't touch my lips, and my friends is always begging me to take them on macrobiotic trips. Yes, they are. All but night I take out my strong box that I keep under lock and key, and I take it off to my closet where nobody else can see. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south, then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth.
Ah, yes, the old Hostess Twinkie, good for 1,000 years on the shelf.
Yeah,
you know, after the after World War IV and the entire world is radioactive, the only two things that will still be around are cockroaches and Hostess Twinkies. But they'll still taste good. That's the tough thing. I mean, that's the tough thing for kids. How's a kid to know? How can kids, you know, make these kinds of decisions? Well, gee, I like it. I like the taste of it. You know, that little sugar rush is kind of cool. They're not thinking about, you know, having their feet amputated from diabetes 20 years down the road. In the European Union, this is incredible. I mean, it ain't happening in the United States, at least to the best of my knowledge. But in the European Union, this is from Mark Sweeney in The Guardian. Actually, just this last week. An alliance of food companies, including Coca-Cola, Nestle's, Mars, and Burger King, have signed a European Union pledge to stop marketing junk food to children under 12 years old. The group of 11 companies, which represent more than 50% of the food and beverage advertising spent in the entire European Union, all the countries of Europe, have agreed to stop running junk food ads on TV, in print, and on the Internet to under 12s by the end of 2008. No more advertising. On the other hand, here in the United States, now we're advertising prescription drugs on TV. Used to be illegal. Pretty soon they'll probably be bringing back cigarette ads. Anyway, the alliance, which also includes PepsiCo, Kraft, Unilever, Danone, and Ferrero, have agreed not to market products in primary schools, except, quote, where specifically requested by or agreed within the school administration for educational purposes, end quote. It's called the EU Pledge. This new program called the EU Pledge, these 11 companies have agreed to have independently verified monitoring of their reduction in marketing starting in January of 2009. The World Federation of Advertisers Managing Director Stephen Lorke, he says this is part of the industry's response. This is the industry behaving responsibly. Well, I guarantee you that the industry is behaving responsibly because the people of Europe said, damn it, you're going to start behaving responsibly. That's what it comes down to. I mean, it's... On the other hand, here, as Sam and I were talking about, this new 2007 Farm Bill, it's pending in the U.S. Senate, update the Department of Agriculture standards on basically candy, potato chips, soft drinks, things like that. There are some states where the legislatures have taken action, here in Oregon and Washington State, and actually banned some of this stuff. But you know, some serious problems out there. ABC News, Russell Goldman noting 67% of public schools children see junk food ads at school. At school! Elementary school students won't receive gold stars, but rather a taste of the Golden Arches for their good grades in Seminole County, Florida, under a corporate sponsorship that awards high-achieving students with Happy Meals. That's capital H, capital M, trademark. The report card incentive, as the program is known, is explained in the front of specially produced envelopes bearing the image of Ronald McDonald, and in which the report cards for every student in the county's 37 elementary schools are sent home. The incentives are described as food prizes, and a report card of all A's and B's or an attendance record blemished by just two absences is enough to earn a student a free Happy Meal. Isn't that special? The question that we need to be asking ourselves is, how do we stop predators from marketing things to our children that are not good for them? And, you know, this is not to indict an industry. Here's the thing. And I've said this before about Walmart, for example, and other companies like this. My problem is not with the individual company's behavior. I've got no problem with Mars and Nestle's and McDonald's and Burger King and whatnot doing whatever they can to make a profit. That's the American way, as it were. I mean, that's basically private enterprise. That's how it's supposed to work. The problem here is that in a constitutionally limited democratic republic, and we're really going to talk about this issue all day here. In the first hour, it's about how do we deal with restricting the power of capital to hurt children. In the second hour, it'll be how do we restrict the power of capital to hurt we the people collectively, communities. We're going to get into this whole thing about private fire departments are making a comeback. And in our third hour, how do we stop the power of private capital from changing public policy? Share in the third hour some startling things you never knew about prohibition and about, you know, the alcohol prohibition back in the 30s and about pot prohibition now. But the bottom line is the companies are just making money. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing. What we're supposed to be doing as citizens is saying, this is great that you're going to make money. Here are the limits we're putting on your money-making activities so that you don't harm the public good. And that's what our legislators are proposing in this case. And it's in my opinion, a good thing. That's how government should work. It should say, it's fine if you want to make money, but there are limits on what you can do to make that money, particularly when it comes to harming us and particularly when it comes to harming our children. That's the line that we're not going to let you step over. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our toll-free number all across the United States and, frankly, all around the world. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, participate in our blog on the front page or on our message boards, and also the blog over at AirAmerica.com. Welcome back to the program. Brenda in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Brenda, I'll be in your fine town tomorrow night. Friday night, actually, I'll be speaking, so...
Fred, welcome. I wish I could be there to see you. I don't think I'll be able to, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, in any case, thank you for listening. What's up?
Tom, I don't disagree with you at all about the junk food and the vending machines. But I personally wonder whatever happened to the good home-cooked food that they used to serve in the schools that was cooked at the school by lunch ladies.
Mm-hmm.
And now they get prefab junk that's reheated at the schools, and nobody wants to eat it. I don't blame them. I'd head straight for the junk food out of the vending machines, too.
Because in many schools, the preparation and delivery of the meals has been outsourced. It's been given to private contractors.
And I'm sure they would say that it's less expensive that way, but sometimes I wonder if it actually is less expensive, and I would be willing to pay more so that my kid can get a decent home-cooked meal.
Yeah, well said, Brenda. I absolutely agree with you. Thank you very much for the call and for making that point. In fact, let me just, you know, expand on that a little bit. I remember when our oldest was in school, we were living in Atlanta, Georgia, and this was in the Cobb County schools, and the The food was junk food. The school food, it was like, you know, peanut butter with sugar on white bread, you know, the sweetened peanut butter on white. And so we were sending her with healthy meals. And she grew up a vegetarian. All three of our kids did. And the school was like, you know, you upset about this. And so Kendra actually wrote an essay, a brilliant essay, about why I'm a vegetarian. And this was in part our effort to, you know, justify her taking healthier meals with her, not just, you know, not eating the school meat. And it worked its way all the way up to the principal, and they actually added vegetarian entrees to the school lunch lineup at the time, and got healthier. But that was back in the day when schools were actually making their own food, as Brenda pointed out. And unfortunately, now we're corporatizing our schools, among everything else. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich.
Hi, Tom. Two quick points. I'm a former teacher of middle school and high school, and I come down on both sides of the fence on this first issue. I believe when kids are required to be in an area, then they should be free from corporate branding. I just think the whole concept of a captive target market for corporations in our children is wrong. For extracurricular activities like sports, I don't have any problem with Nike providing apparel and being able to advertise. That doesn't bother me. And just a sidebar to this discussion, a problem that I encountered here in the Bible Belt is, you know, the kids were assigned seats in lunchroom, and one of the local churches would send their young life reps in as a guest of one of the church members. Usually the boys' table would have an attractive female college-age student that would come in and eat lunch and invite them to the lock-in on Friday night, you know, basically recruiting. And it was very slick, and had a real problem with that as well. So I guess my basic message is, when kids are required by law to be at school, they are not a target market for corporations or churches. And
right.
That's all I got. Thanks,
yeah.
Tom.
Whether it's evangelism from the corporation or evangelism from the church, well said, you know, very well said. Sharon in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Sharon.
Hi. I just wanted to respond to a comment that you made a few minutes ago, Tom, and that was about big business or business in general, and the raison d'etre is to make money. And that's true. That's true. But I'd like to know why we cannot instill in our corporations or businesses a little bit like they did in Europe, where I lived for many years, and that is the idea of giving back to the community, to the country as a whole, that is also a part of business.
We can't do it because the Dodge brothers sued Henry Ford back in the day. Back in, I forget what year it was, but it was like in the 1910s or 19-teens or 20s. There, Henry Ford, and he takes credit for it, or history gives him credit for it. It was actually the idea of his business partner and his wife. He was opposed to it. But he raised the salary, almost doubled, more than doubled the salary of his workers. And, you know, when it became a positive PR thing for him, he said, you know, I'm going to pay them enough that they can buy my own product, that they can buy a Model T. It raised him up to $5 a day, as I recall. And the Dodge brothers, who were competing with Henry Ford, sued him and said, you can't do that because you're reducing shareholder value. You're reducing the value of the stock. And it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that a corporation has to make, or the managers of a corporation, the executives of a corporation, have to make every decision in the context of, is this going to increase or decrease shareholder value? And if it's going to increase the value of the stock and increase the amount of the dividends paid to shareholders, then you do it. And if it's going to decrease it, then you can't do it. And so, you know, corporations have a singular morality, and that's profit. And that's why it's so important in a nation, in a world by and large, but particularly in a nation where we say, you know, capitalism, free enterprise is something that we're going to accept, in fact, something we're going to encourage, that we put constraints on it. Because that's a morality that is inconsistent in many ways with the human necessity of survival. You know, you can make profits selling poison. You can make a profit hurting people. There is a lot of ways that you can make profits that we as a society say, nah, not going to let you do that. And you know, that's, but it, in answer to your question, Sharon, you know, it goes back to the Supreme Court, unfortunately. So, but thanks for the call and for your comment. Keith in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Tom. As a conservative, I have to compliment you. You're the best at giving your opponents a chance to actually speak. And so compliments to you.
Thank you.
I don't think that we use our wallets well enough in our society, and our activism is misplaced. We go to the government to change laws instead of controlling companies' behavior through our spending habits. And
you're talking about boycotts.
Yes. And I think it's a much more powerful tool than trying to get laws passed through Congress.
When was the last time a boycott was actually successful?
Oh, I can't remember in my lifetime when one was ever really tried. But it's not just boycotts. It's individuals and groups deciding not to buy products that they don't believe in for a purpose and advertising that need. Let me, an example. Why are we trying to lobby the government to change fuel economy standards when we could lobby people to buy more fuel-efficient cars?
Because the fuel efficiency standards, your argument is ultimately that let's flip it back on the responsibility of individuals.
And also, individuals
are not as well informed here's how a conservative would spin this. They would say, okay, Tom, what you're saying is that many of us are too dumb to figure this stuff out, and therefore the government has to come in and say, okay, the companies
exactly.
have to make... Right. And my response to that is many of us are too busy. Many of us are not well enough informed, sure. And that's one of the reasons why we have representative government, is to say, you guys take care of that stuff. Would you please? Would you make sure that we're not destroying the world in which we live? Would you make sure that we're not dependent upon the Saudis? Because, I've got to make a living here, and I don't have time to be trying to figure out what the difference is in CAFE standards between one company and another, or whether, this car is getting 36 miles to the gallon versus 37 miles to the gallon, how that's going to impact the planet.
But you see, Tom, they don't take care of it. The companies get their loopholes. These fuel efficiency standards are going to be wind up so watered down that it will render it meaningless.
Right, and
all of that effort will be wasted when it could have been spent on a TV campaign imploring people to buy more fuel-efficient cars.
But see, where are you going to get the money for that from? I mean, argument that you're making is an argument for public funding of campaigns
lobbying
illegal.
Privately, $3 to $4 billion a year is raised for environmental groups like the Sierra Club and other organizations. People have money; they're just spending it in the wrong way. They're lobbying government instead of lobbying people.
Yeah,
and it's not working.
The Montgomery bus boycott, the grape boycott of Cesar Chavez, those were back in the 60s, and those were relatively successful, but they took a long, long time, and they were appeals to morality rather than attempts to force a corporation into changing behavior.
That bus boycott was economic against the city of Montgomery. Make no mistake about it. I just think it's something for people to think about.
Yeah, well, the city of Montgomery did not go bankrupt or was not facing bankruptcy or anything like that.
No.
And now you've got, with the Animal Terrorism Prevention Act and some of this new legislation, the Patriot Act, if you engage in a boycott against a company, specifically with the Animal Terrorism Protection Act, if you engage in a boycott against a company because you don't like the fact that they're using animals and testing their cosmetics or they're selling meat, you can be charged as a terrorist. I mean, this is like...
Well, I hardly think that would happen if you boycotted, for instance, Exxon for not cleaning up the Valdez accident properly, which should have been done by consumers. That's
if you only have one company. Gas station within a mile of your house, so you can...
You know that's not true.
But that's true for me. I only have one gas station within a mile of my house.
Well, why don't you drive 2 miles then? Isn't it worth it?
Well, the other nearest gas station, which is probably 2 miles away, is a Chevron. I've got a Chevron station and an ExxonMobil station. It's like, which one is least toxic? At a certain point, we have to say we are going to rationally regulate corporate behavior.
Forget about the power of the consumer. That's the problem.
Well, but the consumer doesn't have that much power in a monopolistic world.
We disagree on that. Thanks for giving me my time.
You're welcome, Keith. Thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Hey! Yeah, yeah, yeah.
9 minutes before the hour. The Tom Hartman Program, by the way, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And I would argue our Constitution defines it as one. We just need a Supreme Court ruling to that effect, although we've got the wrong Supreme Court, and we'll have an even worse one if a Republican gets elected president, but don't get me started on that. John in Northampton, Massachusetts. Hey, John, thanks for calling the show. What's up?
Hi, John. How are you?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind today, John?
Well, I just want to call about the last caller who was advocating, injecting boycotts and those kind of strategies.
Right.
And it just seems that if we operate that way, that people who have more money will get more democracy than people that have, you know, less money.
Yeah, the biggest argument, frankly, and I should have brought it up against what he was suggesting, is that whenever somebody says, and I've been ranting about this for years, when somebody says vote with your dollars, that means that the person with the most dollars has the most votes, and that's not democracy. Also, broadly speaking, it causes us to think of ourselves as consumers rather than as citizens. Citizens participate in a democracy. Consumers participate in a marketplace. But the marketplace is regulated by the democracy. So it's really important that we be doing things in the context of our citizen role, that is, via government, if we're going to affect the marketplace in ways that make it less toxic and less destructive. Excellent point, John. Thank you very much for calling and bringing it up. I appreciate it. Darren in Portland. Hey, Darren.
Hi there. Tom, I appreciate your insight. I love your show. I'll try and keep this brief. When I got out of college, I started my own vending company where I started placing Coke machines, Pepsi machines, snack machines in businesses and apartment complexes. Shortly thereafter, I was able to do business with a company called Verifine that sold juice drinks in 12-ounce cans that I was able to walk into schools and say, you should have a juice machine sitting next to this Pepsi machine.
Right.
So it was very easy. And what I found was that even though I sold like 100% orange juice, grape juice, apple juice, the other selections were more fructose-based. I know that for a fact that the Pepsi machine sold 10 to 1 to what I was selling. And when I opened the door to restock my machines, the things that I was restocking was the high fructose berry drinks.
Yeah.
And my point being is that the Pepsi machine was being hit so readily. And Pepsi, by the way, is owned by the parent company that owns Kentucky Fried Chicken and Pizza Hut. And wouldn't they just love to get their grips on that? So at the end of the day, if you leave the choice up to the children and say, you know, let the buyer beware, then, you know,
What we're talking about here, Darren, ultimately are drugs. If you define a drug as something that alters mood, that people will change their behavior to get, that people will take even when they know it's not in their best interest, and that is a concentrated or distilled form of something, a real substance. In other words, you know, heroin is highly refined opium, for example. If that's how you define an addictive drug, then I would submit to you that the caffeine that's in a lot of this junk food and the high fructose corn syrup and other types of refined sugars are drugs. And the proof of it is what you just said. The kids will go out of their way to buy essentially these highly refined products, what I would call drugs, as opposed to just saying, yeah, I'll take the fruit juice.
And just on top of that, Tom, just briefly, and I'll step aside, the fact is that you're catering to children who are determining their marketing at that point, and the corporatocracy understands that, and that's why they're trying to get them early.
Yeah, exactly. You're establishing behaviors that patterns of behaviors that will last for a lifetime. Norman in Washington, D.C. Hey, Norman, what's on your mind today?
Tom, hey, how's it going, brother?
Just great. What's up?
I want to make a couple quick points about basically disparity in pay in the job market. Mm-hmm. I remember, I think it's, may have been, I don't remember, in my history books I've learned, around 50, in the 50s or 40s or whatever, a CEO, and this is a good gauge across timelines, any timeline, a CEO would make around 40 times as much as the average employee.
Yeah, that was from the 1930s, from the end of the roaring 20s, from the 1930s right up until the late 70s.
Now they make around 400 times.
Right.
As much as the average employee. And these sorts of things are just ridiculous. You know, the CEO can't live off $20 million a year. He has to live off $120. Yeah. So the lower employees can take 10, 15 grand less a year. You know, that's how a layperson should be able to talk about this thing.
You're absolutely right, Norman. And the thing that brought this about, in my opinion, in a large part, was the end of the progressive income tax. That we had income tax, and thank you very much for your call. We had income tax rates that were 71%, and Reagan dropped them down to 27%. And guess what happened? The pay of people at the very top exploded, and where did that money come from? The pay of people in the middle and at the bottom fell apart. Warren in Seattle. Hey, Warren.
Hey, Tom. That comment you made about the drugs and all is exactly what I was thinking about. You know, the fact is that when kids take stimulants and overtax their adrenal system, then the only way they can feel normal is if they take more stimulants. And with time, that ends up a lot of times with people that want to use coke or meth or things like that in their later life because...
You're suggesting caffeine is a gateway drug?
In a sense, yeah, it is. They are gateway drugs. And you know, I see so many people here in Seattle. It's the land of coffee. And, I mean, they're drinking 2 and 3 triple lattes a day.
Well, this is why when I was a kid, I'm starting to sound like an old fart here, but when I was a kid, my parents would not allow me to drink coffee, would not allow me to drink caffeinated tea. And the soft drinks were a, you know, once on Saturday treat. All right, we go to the A&W, and I'd get an A&W root beer with ice cream in it or something. I mean, that was the big treat for the week, and that was it. And
well, I think you and I are the same age, so yeah, it's the same thing.
We need to recreate that as a model. I think that's an appropriate behavioral model for parents these days. Warren, thank you for the call. Oh, amazing. And this is, you know, how we're protecting arguably the commons of our kids. How about the commons of our homes? What happens when your home is on fire and the fire department says, nah, we're not going to come? Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So yesterday, I defended Sweden. We had a conservative on who went off on, you're just anti-freedom, Tom. And I said, you know, this regulation of industry, this role, big government role, you're anti-freedom. And my response was, you mean like Sweden is anti-freedom? Yes, like Sweden. You know, it's not a free country. And I'm like, gee, I thought the Swedes thought it was a free country. So I get this email from Scott, who lives he also hangs out in our chat site, in our chat room from time to time. It lives in Sweden. And he says, hey, Tom, glad you're well and getting better. After you use Sweden as an example of lack of freedom that creates happiness, your guest Terrence Jeffries tried to sneak in that Swedes practice euthanasia on the population. What world do these right-wingers habitate? As a 25-year expat residing in Sweden, I find it is precisely the regulation of the economy that gives me, a citizen, more freedom to reach my potential, precisely because of being relieved of worrying about catastrophic medical costs, rehabilitation, sudden layoffs, subsidized unaffordable education from daycare to PhD for my kids. Furthermore, this regulation ensures me 5 weeks of vacation for real rest and relaxation, a living wage, proactive food and drug regulation, consumer protection, environmental protection, and on it goes. Regulation that is people-oriented, quality-of-life-oriented, certainly does regulate corporations, and that's why it is liberating for the humans among us, for the rest of us. The Swedes are not so dumb as to kill the golden corporate goose, but they balance the real needs of the geese with the needs of the populations the geese serve. Scott. Hey, Scott, thank you for that note and for saying it so well and for listening to us in Sweden. Which brings us to, you know, in the first hour we were talking about the commons of our kids, basically, the commons of our families. And how do we protect them? What can we do? How do we, you know, in large part, how do we protect them from corporate predators in our schools? Now, how about protecting us? How do we protect ourselves? How our homes? Miriam Raftery wrote an absolutely brilliant piece published over at rawstory.com about a trend in the United States that has been picking up steam, arguably over the last, I don't know, 2-3 decades. This goes back to Reagan and Reagan's whole notion that government is bad, anything government does is bad, and therefore get government out of the way, right?
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Right. So Miriam starts out by talking about the Great Fire of London in 1666 and how private fire insurance companies were put together not just to pay for, you know, the damage to your home if it burns down, like the way that we think of fire insurance, but to run fire trucks. Fire trucks that would go to your house and protect your house from fire if the house next door was on fire and the fire could move, as they tended to do in highly concentrated areas, population areas like London. You know, fire would just sweep down an entire city block because the houses were all connected or very, very close together. And if a report of a fire came out and the fire trucks got dispatched and they got to your house and you didn't have a plaque on your house, the medallion that said that you had paid your fee that year to the fire company, the fire insurance company, then the fire truck just said, okay, see you later. And they went back to the fire station, let your house burn down. And that practice had migrated to the United States, and Ben Franklin actually was one of the first guys to organize a volunteer fire department that was of, by, and for the people, that would respond to any fire anywhere, regardless of whether somebody had paid some company. And as a consequence of Ben Franklin's efforts in Philadelphia and others all around the United States, over the years, we've come to believe, to experience, to know that a part of our commons, a part of the commonwealth, the stuff that we all collectively own, our commonwealth, is our police and fire protection. That we're protected from predators by our police and we're protected from the dangers of fire, including the, you know, fire bugs, you know, arsonists. You could toss them into the category of predators, too, I suppose. But all forms of fire. We're protected from fire by our fire department, and we all pay for this through our taxes. And we agree that we are going to collectively do that. Well, the system is breaking down, and it's breaking down in part as a direct consequence of that Reagan mindset that I just shared with you a minute ago. As Miriam Rafferty notes, today a decline in public funding for firefighting services has sparked explosive growth in the private sector. The world's largest insurance company, American Insurance Group, now has wildfire protection units. These are essentially fire departments in 150 U.S. zip codes. During the 2007 California wildfires, AIG's firefighters saved homes in wealthy areas while less fortunate neighbors were left with rubble. A trade group for private firefighters founded in 2000 now represents 10,000 private firemen. As Miriam Raftery writes over at rawstory.com, Rancho Bernardo, a wealthy San Diego community that lost 365 homes during the October fires, has just one fire station for a 24-mile area. That's wrong, right? The city doesn't meet minimum standards for accreditation by the National Fire Protection Association. Their standard is every 9 miles, you got to have at least one fire station, one fire department station. They have one for a 24-mile area. In a blistering interview earlier this month, San Diego Fire Chief Tracy Jarman told the San Diego Union Tribune that the city was left on its own to fight the October wildfires and was woefully unprepared. So here you had two fires blazing in Rancho Bernardo. And the fire chief of San Diego, Tracy Jarman, calls up Cal Fire, California Fire, the state backup, and says, we need immediate air support, and I need 150 strike teams from the state. Give me 750 fire engines and 3,000 firefighters, please, now. The state's response? Sorry, we got nothing. Nothing. So, you know, Cal Fire couldn't respond. But this company that I was telling you about, American Insurance Group, they had their trucks on the scene AIG, Cal Fire balked, as Miriam Rafferty writes, AIG firefighter Sam Craze was saving homes for clients. We love putting out fires, Craze told Bloomberg News, noting that his unit was able to extinguish a fire in a nearby uninsured home. But, he added, adjacent homeowners weren't always so lucky. Quote, there were a few instances where we were spraying and the neighbor's house went up like a candle. Well, after all, the neighbor didn't pay the insurance company. And the city didn't want to tax itself. I mean, this is what happens when you have, I swear, no more taxes kinds of things going on. Last month, former San Diego Fire Chief Jeff Bowman told a congressional hearing that he left his job in April of 2006 over, quote, abject frustration, end quote, because repeated recommendations went unheeded. He said that he urged the county to buy at least 50 fire engines, each staffed by 12 firefighters, and add 22 fire stations. It wasn't done. There's a company based out of Oregon, Firebreak Spray Systems Company. They treated about 200 homes in Rancho Bernardo. This is in San Diego. In Southern California, an Oregon company is putting out fires. Why? Because those people paid the premium, the fire insurance premium. As the CEO, Jim Amott, of Firebreak said, he said, we had 8 trucks responding to fires there in Southern California. 8 trucks. In Lakewood, Illinois. There's another company, the American Emergency Service Corporation. Now, their employees are non-union. They say, hey, you know, we've got our non-union employees. We can provide fire services cheaper than the unionized employees of the state or the city or the county. But, okay, you take away the union benefits and you pay people less. Does that mean that the city or that the users, the homeowners, are actually going to pay less for fire services? How is the CEO going to get paid? How are the stockholders going to get their dividends? See, what we're doing to our fire services is not unlike what we've done to our healthcare services. There's going to be a small number of companies that are going to make a lot of money, and you're going to have a lot of people who are not going to get the services, and that's exactly what's going on. Another private firefighting contractor, this again from the story in Raw Story, Rural Metro, provides private fire protection services to over 25 communities, according to the company's websites. The U.S. government is using private contractors in firefighting efforts on federal lands. What happened to the old fire service? What happened to the Forest Service? Well, you know, we got to privatize these things. So, private, and what's the consequence of privatization? I'll tell you right after the break. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Minutes past the hour. Quick heads up, 7 o'clock Friday night, December 14th, I'll be at the University of Minnesota bookstore at the Kauffman Memorial Union, giving a riff on Cracking the Code, my new book, and taking questions and offering answers to the extent that I can, and signing books. It should be a great time. I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to visiting Minneapolis and traveling through the Larry Craig Memorial Airport there. Let's not call that. All right, increasingly, here's what we're going to be hearing. Here's what people are hearing, is this so-called language of personal responsibility.
You know, it's up to you to protect your family. You're the one. It's not. You shouldn't depend on government. Government won't do it. Look at what happened with Katrina. Those people just weren't self-reliant enough.
This is the essentially anti-American, anti-small-d democratic, ultimately anti-human message of the corporatists. Yeah, just turn it over to the corporations. They'll take care of you. Turn it over to business. They'll take care of you. Somehow the profit motive is going to make everything better. Well, the fact of the matter is the profit motive doesn't make everything better. In Philadelphia, privatized fire hydrants froze because of lack of maintenance. I mean, after all, why maintain it? It's an expense. Slate Magazine did an article about this in 2002, about the privatization of firefighting. Quote, privatizing firefighting was supposed to cut costs, but it has done nothing of the sort. Last summer, which was an average fire season, was the most costly on record. The 2001 fire season cost an average of $1,340 an acre to fight fires in national forests. This is with a privatized fire service. 270% more than it had the year before. So it costs more to fight fires when it's privatized, which only makes sense because, yeah, you can have a private corporation do things a little more efficiently by squeezing their employees. You know, yeah, we're not going to have unionized employees. They're, you know, instead of making $30 an hour, they're going to make $12 an hour. Instead of having a pension, they're going to have, you know, maybe $100 a year in their 401k. Instead of having a full health insurance program, they're going to have, you know, they're going to be able to contribute $100 a month to something that'll take care of them in case of a catastrophe. Yes, you can squeeze your employees. And let's say you can squeeze, you know, $20,000, $30,000 a year out of each one of your employees and reduce the expenses by that amount. Well, here's the problem. You got that money left over. Are you going to reduce the cost to San Diego or to the citizens of San Diego when you provide those services or to Portland or to any place? Are you going to reduce the costs by that amount? No, of course not. You're going to take that money and hand it to your stockholders. You're going to take that money and pay CEO salary. You're going to take that money and use it for marketing and advertising and more money than that. And you're going to use it to grease the palms of your buddies. Back to the article in Raw Story. Some private firefighting firms or their owners have made hefty donations to the Republican Party and prominent elected officials. Mike Wheelock, owner of Grayback Forestry, Inc. in Oregon, one of the largest and most elite private firefighting contractors with substantial federal contracts, gave a whopping $25,000 to the Republican National Congressional Committee in 2006, as well as large donations to George W. Bush's presidential campaign and other prominent GOP leaders. Now, as I said in the last hour, you know, in the context of Walmart or foods in our schools or whatever, I am all in favor of people starting businesses to make money. No problem. The problem that I have, and this isn't an industry that I think should be outlawed, and I don't think the people who are doing anything wrong, and I don't think that it's, you know, God bless them, you know, saving people's homes. The problem is that it shouldn't be necessary. We are creating market opportunities by failing to fulfill our obligations as citizens. We are creating market opportunities by throwing our brothers and sisters, our children and parents and grandparents and grandchildren to the wolves, or to the fire in this case. This is the essence of Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism. That by creating, by having disasters and not collectively, we the people, not collectively saying, okay, we're here for us. We're here for us by running the fire department. We're here for us by running the police department. We're here for us by showing up when natural disasters happen like Katrina or the fires in San Diego. Instead of saying, yes, we're here, we're going to do it, what we have are these privatized companies. I had no idea that it was private, for-profit fire companies down in San Diego that were putting out some of the fires while other houses burned because they hadn't paid the companies. But it turns out that's the case. What's wrong with this picture? At what point are we as Americans going to say, wait a minute, this religion of privatization, this religion of trashing so-called big government, this religion of turn it over to the corporations and let us be beholden to them rather than responsible to ourselves through a democratically elected representative government is a failure. It's wrong. It doesn't work.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, there's a blog there as well, and our message board. Also, there's a blog over at AirAmerica.com. And Mark in Los Angeles. Hey, Mark. Whoop. Mark in Los Angeles just vanished. Glenn in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to let you know that because of customer pressure, a national vending company for years has introduced something called balanced choice items in vending machines and cafeterias. And basically they have a threshold on fat content, sodium content, and calories per serving. They've been doing this for years. And the biggest I work for one of the companies, and the biggest companies that take advantage of this are health insurance companies and hospitals and major corporations.
Interesting.
So if
the vending machines in their facilities.
Correct. So in other words, there's a couple health insurance companies in Portland, Oregon that are insisting on a 100% quote unquote balanced choice items. And I wouldn't classify them as good for you, but they're less bad than the traditional regular potato chips.
Right. But we don't see that in our schools.
There are schools that do it, but they're few and far between.
Yeah.
And sales do go down a little bit when they do put the balanced choice.
When you got a healthier stuff. Yeah. Glenn, thanks for the heads up on that. That's the go ahead.
But that option is out there, and it's a national company, and I don't know if you'll let me say the name of it. But
sure, go ahead.
The national company is called Canteen Vending, and they have a dining service called Urus Dining, and they do the same thing in school cafeterias.
Yeah.
And I tried to help my local school get them in there for the balanced choice items, and they chose another company that had a lower bid, and they used the more less healthy food items. So
well,
a lot of it has to do with money and profit.
Yeah, and it's a tip of the hat to a company that said, hey, here's a market opportunity. We can do well by doing good, and you know all the better. And what a shame that our public schools here in Portland are contracting, or anywhere in the country for that matter, are contracting with private corporations to say, you bring the food in, when they could just be making it themselves from locally grown food with a local employee and not have all the overhead and all that kind of thing and actually produce a better product. Rod in St. Michael, Minnesota. Hey, Rod, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I just wanted to comment on something a previous caller had mentioned. He was talking about it being a personal responsibility to look at fuel standards or whatnot, look at mileage standards when selecting a car. Now, that's all well and good. It seems kind of a libertarian philosophy, though, and I wonder how far people like that are willing to put it. I mean, you could talk about drug crimes. You know, if people don't want to use cocaine, then they won't buy cocaine. Or pornography, if people don't like what they see on primetime TV, then they can turn it off. It seems to me like it's always regulation of personal behavior is something that they support, but regulating business is something they're against.
Well, actually, this is where the libertarians are relatively consistent. You know, they believe that pornography should be legal and totally decriminalized. They believe that that all drugs should be legal and totally decriminalized, that brothels should be legal and totally decriminalized, and that government should play no part in the marketplace. I mean, these are the positions that Ron Paul was espousing when he ran for president as a libertarian, and I believe by and large he's espousing now as he's running as a Republican. Do away with Social Security, do away with public education, let people, leave it up to individual responsibility. If your parents are wealthy as a child, then you're going to have a good childhood. If your parents are not wealthy, then, hey, you made a bad choice getting born into that family, and you're going to be punished for it. That's the bottom line. Rod, thanks for the call and for the point. Richard in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Richard.
Hi. I just thought it ironic that one of the main charitable organizations for children with cancer is Ronald McDonald House.
Yeah, I don't think that that's an irony that they intended, and I'm not sure that we can demonstrate a link between cancer and McDonald's products, although and McDonald's actually has responded to some pressure in the marketplace and improve the quality of their foods. But you know, the larger point here is, and this is an important one, the larger point here is that people will point to things like Ronald McDonald House, and good on McDonald's for doing this, by the way. They'll point to them and say, isn't that marvelous what McDonald's doing? They're providing a service that the state can't provide, that the state doesn't provide. We don't have national health care. We don't have services for families whose kids have cancer, things like that. And you know, they're getting some benefit out of it. Well, the reason they're doing it is because it increases their bottom line. Again, going back to that lawsuit with the Dodge brothers and Mr. Ford, it has to prove whatever you do has to improve your profitability. If it doesn't improve your profitability, you can't do it. And so, you know, being charitable at a certain level, you know, increases the perception of the company as a good and positive company. I would argue that broadly speaking, is probably a good thing. I mean, I've been involved in corporate charity over the years, but every corporation that I've ever been the CEO of or run or owned at various times, you know, we engage in charity, but you do it because there's something in it for the corporation. That said, that should never replace the public obligation, the we the people obligation. Again, it gets back to, are we citizens or are we consumers first? And I would submit to you that we should be citizens first and consumers second. And conservatives want us to be consumers first and citizens second. In fact, they'd like to take the citizen part and just throw that out the window and say, don't worry, we'll let Bill Gates run the show. He knows what's going on. Jason in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Jason.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Just great. What's up?
I have a question for you. I'm a new listener to the show, a big fan of your politics. I recently found out that you're an expert on ADHD. I'm a father of an 11-year-old daughter who has ADHD, and she's had it for many years. My question for you is, what's a good layman book with practical methods of dealing with ADHD, and so something in reference to the long- and short-term effects of derivative-like drugs like Ritalin?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Jason, I cannot offer you any medical advice. But in terms of books, you know, Ned Halliwell and John Rady have written a couple of great books. Driven to Distraction is the oldest and still stands as a classic text. My most recent book on ADHD is titled The Edison Gene. And my first book on ADHD was titled ADD, A Different Perception. And I would say of the books that I've written, those are the two best. So, you know, in a way, and thank you for the call, in a way, this gets into the larger issue once again of we the people and what are we going to do? Because here we have with ADHD, you have kids who are, their brains are wired differently. Now, you know, it may be genetic. And in fact, in the Edison gene, I get into this, the DRD4 gene. Or D4DR gene, I guess it is, and the D2DR gene and the dopamine trans. These are all dopamine generating, dopamine detecting, or dopamine transporting, the DT genes. And it has to do with a neurochemical called dopamine. And the bottom line is that these kids, they would make great hunter-gatherers in a hunting-gathering world, you know, if they were out there, because they're scanning their environment constantly, where in a hunting-gathering world, they would notice, hey, there's a rabbit over there, I can have that for lunch, right? But in a classroom, that's called being distractible. And they make very quick decisions. If they're chasing a rabbit through the forest and a deer runs by, they don't even have to think about it. Boom, they're on that deer. You know, they don't sit down with a pad and pen and say, let's do a risk-benefit analysis. In a classroom, that's called impulsivity. And they love getting out there every day and you know, hey, let's go out there in a world where there's things that want to eat me as much as I want to eat them. That helps hunting-gathering people in a classroom that's called risk-taking. Or disruptive behavior. So we've got these kids who are wired to live in a world that's somewhat different than the classrooms that we ask them, that we force them to sit in. They're wired as hunters rather than as farmers. And we look at the wiring of their brain and we say, okay, this kid is wired in such a way that they need high levels of stimulation. They are easily distracted. The bottom line, they need high levels of stimulation, and that's 90% of it. You reduce classroom size down to, you know, 15, 20 kids, and 75% of all your ADD problems in a school will go away. It's really that simple. But that's expensive. So we look at these kids and we say, okay, we can modify our schools so that all kids can learn in them, although that's going to cost more money. That's going to increase taxes. Or we can go into the brains of individual kids and say, we're going to modify your brain with this drug so that your brain now functions in a way that's compliant with this school, with this classroom. And that's actually very profitable. The ADHD industry is a $1 billion-a-year industry. So, I mean, that's one way to look at it. Now, that said, I would be the first to say that if a parent has no choice, if they have a public school that doesn't work for their ADHD kid and they don't have the option of homeschooling or of private schools, which are, the, in my opinion, the best first two options, if they don't have any other choice, then the consequences of failure in a school are more destructive to a child than the side effects of the medication in many cases. And so I'm not an opponent of medication per se. I just think it's weird that as a society we're buying into this conservative meme of it's the individual's fault and society has no role to play in this, and let's make sure that an industry makes $1 billion on this thing in the meantime. So anyhow, end of rant. Thanks for the call, Jason. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. It's Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Yeah, we got an attitude. The attitude is, we're citizens, not consumers. It's a democracy, not an autocracy. Tom in Pismo Beach, California. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program. I'm fine, but I can hardly hear you.
Oh, sorry, I was on speakerphone while I was folding my laundry. Can you hear me better now?
I can, yes.
Yeah, I'm a U.S. Forest Service firefighter.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we still are out there, but the thing is, the Forest Service is completely bankrupt. They're downsizing everything, and all these fires get paid for, at least the federal portion, out of a super fund started
right.
by Teddy Roosevelt. And fire crews, along with other natural resource parts of the U.S. Forest Service, are using that to fund their budget.
Ouch.
And they're losing firefighters because of the extremely low pay and lack of benefits to all kinds of outside organizations, Cal Fire, everything. I mean, the first time I was hoisted out of a helicopter, I was making $11.85 an hour.
Wow, that's not good.
Yeah, you know, and we're actually forced by law to lease our helicopters by private contractors. I work on a helitack crew. We get flown into fires on a helicopter, you know, to keep it fast and small. We're a rappel crew.
Right.
And they don't have that ship year-round for training to keep guys current, anything, because they have to lease it for 6 months from a private company.
Yeah,
and
you can bet is passing off tons of money to Republicans in particular, but Democrats as well in the House or the Senate or in the state, you know, legislature, and thus hey, let's have the wonders of privatization here.
Oh, exactly. And part of our duty is at the end of the day, because we helitack crews also run the helibase on major fires, is we'll tally up, we'll do a cost analysis, because I'm on a pretty major helitack crew. We do a lot of we run a lot of helibases, and we'll do the cost analysis, and at the end of the day, because of all these leased helicopters, you'll have helicopters charging over $20,000 for one day of fire suppression activities.
Wow.
And these are helicopters that would be easily cheaper if they were owned instead of leased.
Right, owned by the government. But, you know, we're leasing them from private corporations because somebody
mm-hmm.
bought into this religion of privatization and somebody else's palm is being greased. Tom,
exactly.
Thank you for sharing your experience with us. I appreciate the call.
Thanks yeah, thank you. You have a good one.
Thanks. Good to hear from you. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
I am really in the belly of the beast right now. I am in the basement of the House of Representatives. It's Republican Radio Row.
Oh, my goodness. Seriously, Republican Radio Row?
Yeah.
How come I'm not there?
Well, I've been trying to actually convince them to get the opposition down here, and
yeah.
maybe I'll be able to do it for State of the Union. I'm working on them.
Any Republican Radio Row, count me in. I'm doing CPAC this year. I'll be at the conservative. I did it last year. It's some of the best radio. It's so
absolutely.
Much fun. You know, conservative after conservative after conservative. Man, I love it. So what's going on in Washington, D.C. today, Ellen?
Okay, quite a bit going on, actually. Let's first talk about those tapes. As you know, Mr. Hayden, CIA General Hayden, is going to be testifying today. It's his second day. It's a closed-door testimony. He said he is happy to let the facts take up where they will. He is aware, essentially, that 1 year ago he was deputy director, and he was made aware, he claims, of the tapes. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Now, he will be talking to the full Senate tomorrow behind a closed door session. That's pretty unusual. If he doesn't cancel, but at this point, that is going to be happening. I'm sorry, it is not him tomorrow. It's Mukasey tomorrow before the full Senate.
Hmm.
And also, it looks like Rockefeller said that he is going to call the Inspector General of the CIA, John Helgeson, and John Rizzo, who's their top attorney, and that he may even call Mr. Rodriguez, who, as you know, has retired. But Rockefeller said as early as next week. Also, Representative Waxman, Chairman Waxman, is asking the U.S. Archivist for an opinion about the destruction of the tapes and the legality of that.
Hmm. Interesting. This is the guy that Christy Harvey likes to refer to as the mustache for justice.
Right. Also yesterday, late in the day, Joint Chiefs Mullen testified before the House panel on dealing with the issue of the Taliban. He said that the insurgency is growing, that they have had a violent increase of 27% in Afghanistan from a year ago, suicide bombings up 69%. However, then he said, well, we have more children enrolled in school. He also said that they are not getting cooperation from NATO.
When is somebody going to point out the fact that Afghanistan has never successfully been occupied over the long term by any nation in the history of the world?
Well, you and I know that, but a lot of other people are not paying much attention to that at all.
I mean, you know, they bankrupted the Soviet Union, Afghanistan.
Exactly, and they're going to bankrupt, they're not going to bankrupt us, but they're certainly not helping.
Yeah.
A couple other interesting things. This is the whole issue of the budget. The Blue Dogs had a meeting this morning. It was actually right across the radio row. They were coming into the Republicans to get coffee. They are saying, you need us to Nancy Pelosi for passage of any bills. And one of the things that they've done is they voted against the popcorn legislation. This is the legislation to make the FDA pay a lot more attention to those butter buds or whatever that's in popcorn that make people sick.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, they wanted to punish Lynn Woolsey. She was about to be unseated by a moderate Democrat. She got a lot of Blue Dog money, and they are basically saying your view on Iraq is not going to prevail. And you better pay attention to us, because if you don't pay attention to us, we're going to make your life miserable.
Lynn Woolsey was more progressive than they liked?
Much more progressive than they like, of course. So now what's also happening on the...
So this is like battle within the Democratic Party?
It is a battle within the Democratic Party. And there's also now cross battles on this huge omnibus spending bill that's supposed to come up next week. Obi said... He needs to get
Congressman David Obie from Wisconsin.
Yes, and Chairman Obie said he cannot. He wants to get it before the Senate, and he wants to take out any war money, because unless they can have some conditions about how this war money is going to be spent. McConnell's saying, well, okay, you're going to do that, then we want an across-the-board decrease of 2.5% on all the social programs except for defense.
Wow. Wow, the Republicans are playing hardball with this thing.
Very much so, and they know they got the votes in the Senate to do it.
Amazing. Amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thank you for the update.
Thank you.
Look forward to talking to you soon. 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative
con.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So from the commons of our families, our kids in our schools, to the commons of our fire systems, to the commons of our police, Sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you know. Sometimes you don't even know what you don't know. And sometimes, as the Fireside Theater likes to point out,
you know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. And thinks that you're out of your mind. Everything you know is wrong.
Could be. Former police officer from Texas, Barry Cooper, is with us. He spent 8 years of his life in narcotics interdiction in Texas. Now runs a website called NeverGetBusted.com. Barry, welcome to the program.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Great to have you with us. Your position, first of all, NeverGetBusted.com, interesting website. How to, you know, is it, does it, do coffee grounds really work to throw off the dog sniff, dope sniffing dogs, things like this? How to avoid traffic tickets? It seems that the position that you're taking, particularly with regard to pot, is somewhat in contrast to that of your colleagues and of your history.
Yes. What happened is I matured. I grew up, started raising a family, used logic, reason, and compassion, and realized as a police officer I was causing much greater harm on these families by ripping them apart and putting the parents in prison for marijuana than the side effects of the marijuana itself. And I started making the comparisons of marijuana to alcohol, marijuana being a much safer, nonviolent drug in comparison. And yet we put 830,000 people a year in jail for marijuana possession. And out of that, 400,000 are kids 25 years old and younger, and which ruins their chances for any financial aid. So it just absolutely doesn't make sense to me, nor, you know, a large percentage of America at this point.
Yeah, I think a lot of Americans are with you on that. We're talking with Barry Cooper, former Texas police officer, and his website, NeverGetBusted.com. Barry, I was interested to learn recently that one of the major forces behind the prohibition of alcohol back in the 1920s was John D. Rockefeller. He was he donated the apparently the equivalent of about $60 million in today's money to the Women's Christian Temperance League. He was one of the co-founders or participated with the creation of the Anti-Saloon League in 1893 in Ohio. And, you know, all of this, not because he was so opposed to drinking, although he was a teetotaler, but because most people who were distilling alcohol illegally were using it to fuel their automobiles, not to drink. And he wanted a monopoly for his gasoline. So here we see prohibition being driven, and another organization that came to prominence that had almost completely died out by 1900 came to prominence in 1915 by aligning itself with the Anti-Alcohol League was the Ku Klux Klan. And so, and they did it as, you know, we're the good Christian guys who are concerned about the fate and future of America. So you had this unholy alliance of big money, big business interests, you know, looking out for to try to make gasoline the thing that fuels our cars rather than alcohol. The first cars that were made in the United States were alcohol-based cars, along with the right-wing religious folks. Aren't we seeing the same thing played out since the 1930s with pot?
Absolutely. In fact, the best I can tell, any prohibition laws have always been motivated by something other than keeping America safe. For instance, in 1937, Harry Anslinger, who was the head of the Alcohol Prohibition Task Force, and then when that was lifted, they made him the head of the FBN, Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which later became the Drug Enforcement Administration of today, the DEA. Harry Anslinger in 1937 testified before the Senate, and I'll quote him, "The reason we need to make marijuana illegal in this country is because of its effects on the degenerate races. It often causes white women to seek relations with Negroes and is responsible for the satanic music such as swing and jazz," end quote. So there we have a very religious, racist motive behind marijuana becoming illegal. They debated it for 14 seconds and marijuana became illegal.
Yeah, and really that was just the front. I mean, the group behind all this was the cotton growers and the paper pulp industry, was it not?
Exactly, because they didn't want hemp to take over the timber industry, which it could have easily done. So what better way than to outlaw it, and what better way than to scare people with religion and racism at that time, which they're doing the same on Fox News today, every day, same propaganda.
Yeah, we're talking with Barry Cooper. He's a former Texas police officer, worked in narcotics interdiction for 8 years. He now runs a website, NeverGetBusted.com, and suggests marijuana should be decriminalized. Barry, what percentage of current police officers? I'm assuming that you've probably maintained some contacts in that culture, in that world. What percentage of cops do you think really think that having pot illegal is a travesty?
It's geographical. In the South, where I live, probably 80% of the police think it's still evil and people belong in jail for it. When you go to the West Coast or up in the Northeast, like New York, you might have 20% of the police that think it should still be illegal. So it's definitely a geographical phenomenon that I think has to do a lot with religion.
Mm-hmm. And possibly racism. Again, back to Harry Anslinger's words. What are you suggesting America should do about this problem of hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, if you include their families, having their lives destroyed, not by pot, but by the criminal justice system and the for-profit prison industry that is profiting off the criminalization of pot?
Well, what will happen, history will repeat itself. If you put enough people in jail and enough people are affected, we're busting at the seams, building more prisons than we are universities. Prisons are the number one corporation in the U.S. right now, bringing in billions.
Number one growth industry. Yeah.
Huh?
It's the number one growth industry in the United States.
Yeah, there you go, exactly. So what's going to happen is America will finally get fed up, and I'm not saying any acts of violence, but certainly there is a different attitude shifting in the direction that says, stop putting us in jail or we're going to go nuts. I mean, because I like what one historian said, without people that give up security for freedom deserve neither. And if we think putting people in prison is bringing security to America, it's crazy, because it's not. It's actually taking our freedoms away.
Yeah.
So my point is, what I should say, Rosa Parks had to stand up on a bus one day. America needs to stand up and say enough is enough. It is patriotic not only to break, but to challenge bad laws.
Hmm. That's a strong statement. We're talking with a police officer, former police officer Barry Cooper. His website, NeverGetBusted.com. Barry, you sell a book and a DVD on Never Get Busted Again, Volume 1, Traffic Stops. How do you talk your way out of a ticket?
Well, that's not that DVD doesn't teach people how to talk their way out of a ticket. Its sole purpose is to drastically reduce their chances of going to jail for marijuana possession on a traffic stop.
Oh, interesting. Okay, great.
Right. That's exactly what all of my efforts have to do with, keeping Americans safe from law enforcement. Talking your way out of a speeding ticket to me is not a safety issue, so I don't teach that. I teach exactly how a person can keep from being a nonviolent person placed into jail because of something nonviolent where they have to become violent.
Yeah, this is fascinating that you are framing this as a safety issue, that the law is making us less safe. And yet that's exactly what happened during the prohibition of alcohol, and everybody saw it. It was fairly obvious, what was going on, the criminals that arose, the gangs, and the profit. I mean, from Joe Kennedy running boats across Lake Erie to criminal.
Well, that's exactly it is a huge safety issue. My second video, it's on sale now, but it'll be released January 15th, is Never Get Raided, where I teach people how to spot undercover officers. And then I point out, do you realize, according to the FBI, only 28 police officers have lost their lives in the entire war on drugs in a 10-year period between 1996 and 2005? Compare that to the millions of Americans who have lost their lives, who are doing life sentences in prison, And we can see that this is a safety issue very easily.
Yeah, well said. Barry Cooper, NeverGetBusted.com, the website, former police officer, Texas police officer. Barry, thanks for being with us today.
You bet. I enjoyed it.
Interesting concept. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. Larry Scott coming up next.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Yeah, come along with me on Friday to Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'll be flying out tomorrow afternoon, visiting, flying into the Larry Craig Memorial Airport there in Minneapolis. And Friday at 7 p.m. we'll be at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at the Kauffman Memorial Union. So be there or be square. Larry Scott on the line with us with VAWatchdog.org. Chief cook and bottle washer over there, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom, how are you going to be doing some toe tapping? No, I hope not.
I don't have a wide stance, Larry.
You know, Senator Larry Craig is still on the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. He was moved out of the ranking member position, but they let him keep his position on that committee.
Well, that's interesting. I thought he had been stripped of all of his, pun intended.
He had been stripped of all leadership posts. And so he's no longer the ranking minority member, but he does sit on the committee, and he does continue to raise hell from time to time, and generally he's ignored. Thank goodness.
Yeah. Well, it's good to know that it's a good thing that he's ignored. How can a former Army Surgeon General who was caught up in the Walter Reed scandal and who is also a former executive with a company that got hundreds of millions of dollars from the VA be pitched to Congress as the guy who's going to save the Department of Veterans Affairs?
The answer lies at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Tom. As if you hadn't guessed that.
Surprise,
drill sergeant. Well, we're talking about Dr. James Peake, who is the current nominee for the new Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Very, very carefully packaged. He has absolutely no experience in veterans advocacy or veterans medicine, although he was the Army Surgeon General, so that gives him a little bit of an edge there. He's a decorated Vietnam veteran. Most of all, he's a crony of the White House. And so from the very day in the Roosevelt Room that President Bush introduced him, they began packaging him, and it was very carefully worded. From then, it was press releases from the White House, very carefully worded. And then Peake saying, I will do the right thing. I'll do right by veterans. I will support them. And then there was a 28-page set of documents, which I'll be posting later today, which were his answers to pre-printed questions from the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs when they went into his confirmation hearing, and I have all 28 pages. What's interesting about his responses to the committee is these were not done in general speak, because he's a three-star general, and they were not done in doctor speak. They were done in public relations speak.
In other words, he didn't write them.
No, absolutely not. These were written up at the White House in the public affairs office and then presented to the Senate committee. His hearing was a week ago, was last Wednesday. Absolutely no surprises. Very disappointing. The senators basically rolled over and reread their pre-prepared questions and allowed Dr. Peake to give his pre-prepared responses. But the ultimate packaging, you would have had to have seen the hearing to appreciate this. When Dr. Peake sat down at the witness table, on his left was Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, World War II veteran and recipient of the Medal of Honor. On his right was former Senator Bob Dole, disabled veteran, another World War II hero. This was the wrapping on the package. These two war heroes surrounding him in this hearing sent the message to the committee, this man is bulletproof, he's our boy, do not ask the hard question, do not try to embarrass him, because there will be political consequences.
Do you think there's a possibility, Larry, that he'll actually be a good guy?
You know, there's always that possibility, Tom, and I have to be honest about that. I really do. But we have to look at reality here. We have to look at the two previous VA secretaries nominated by this president and look at the damage they've done to the VA in 7 years. Okay, we have to look at that. why, and I do mean why, would that change at this point in time? It doesn't make sense. And the White House, with all their secretary nominees, have gone back to the well and pulled out yes men who will do their bidding. We have to look at history on this.
Yeah. Okay. Larry, that was the thing that jumped out at me when I was looking at VAWatchdog.org. There's a lot of other stories on your front page. What are the ones that you think are the most important you want to share with us?
Well, I'll tell you what. I would like to go back to something your previous guest said. Your previous guest says we're building more prisons than we are universities.
Right.
And a little bit of history here. You know, the GI Bill coming out of World War II was considered the great savior of this nation. We educated millions and millions of people, the most educated generation we've ever had. What most people don't know, though, was inside the Roosevelt administration, this was not an altruistic thing of let's get these people educated. It was an incredible fear that drove the GI Bill. And speaking of prisons and universities, they knew that millions and millions of veterans coming back to a post-wartime economy would be unemployed. They feared civil unrest. They feared incredible crime in the streets. And somebody said, well, let's get them off the streets and keep them busy. We'll send them to school. So out of this kind of thing of let's stay away from civil unrest came one of the greatest social programs we've ever seen, the GI Bill. And I just thought I'd bring that up because it is time to build more schools rather than prisons.
Right, and a good way to do it would be with a brand new GI Bill.
And we're not doing that. People are trying to do that. Senator Jim Webb is putting this forward, and he's being knocked down at every chance by the administration.
What a shame.
Yeah,
Larry Scott, editor-in-chief over at VAWatchdog.org. Why, keeping an eye on the VA? Because somebody has to. Larry, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Always good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. That our families alive and healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Just during the break, watching a little clip of the Republican debate over at C-SPAN.org, and the moderator asked, all of the Republicans, do you agree with the statement? I'm paraphrasing this from memory, so I may be off just a little bit on some of the words here, but essentially, do you agree with the statement that global climate change is a serious problem or a serious crisis that we need to take seriously? Nobody would raise their hand. Before that, she'd asked a question about free trade, and Tom Tancredo went after NAFTA and said, you know, when we signed NAFTA, we had a $3 billion trade surplus with Mexico. It's been wiped out. It was out almost immediately wiped out, and it's gotten worse. And, you know, our agricultural policies have destroyed the agricultural base of southern Mexico, and it's one of the reasons so many people are coming north. And Fred Thompson says, I think NAFTA has worked out really well. They're exporting a lot of illegal aliens. And so, you know, if you want somebody negotiating your trade deals, you want me. I'm like, what? He says, I really don't have anything to say about this, but, man, it was scary. It was downright scary. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Morgan in Eugene, Oregon, listening on KOPT. Hey, Morgan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I was calling about your, not the VA Watchdog guy, but your previous guest. And,
the police officer.
Yeah, my brother is a cop, and I can let you know that, you know, when he finds someone with marijuana, he usually, you know, just lets them walk because, you know, he thinks it's a nonviolent drug. I mean, one of our legalized drugs is more violent. I mean, how many people that smoke pot start bar fights? Not very many. So,
yeah. No, their problem is when they hit the Twinkies in the aisle in the supermarket. Struggling with the wrapper.
And one of the ironies is that, our Constitution and Declaration of Independence are written on hemp paper.
Yeah, at least in their first drafts. The final drafts are apparently on sheepskin.
Yeah, and George Washington grew hemp on his farm up at Mount Vernon.
Yeah,
Yeah. Anyway.
Morgan, I'm just curious to what extent you think that perhaps your brother, the police officer here in Oregon, ignores people when they've got pot because, as I recall, and I may be wrong on this, but I think I'm right, that possession of less than an ounce is only like a $50 ticket or say it's the equivalent of a jaywalking.
Yeah, it's a misdemeanor. It's not, not even felonious. So.
Yeah. Plus, we have medical marijuana in this
state. Right. And we're one of the 11 states of that. He also, you know, what he worries about is the more the meth problem and dealing with drunk people at bars and on the roads and stuff
like that. Those are legitimate concerns,
Those are the ones that he deals with more aggressively.
Morgan, thank you very much for the call. Well said. Brian in Boulder, Colorado, listening in KKZN. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Tom. Three things real fast. Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia of New York back in the day was against the criminalization of marijuana. And your guy on that subject mentioned Harry Anslinger.
Right.
It seemed to me that that was maybe the name of J. Edgar Hoover's second-in-command and his housemate.
No, that's Clyde Tolson. Harry Anslinger was the guy who was the first head of what we now call the Drug Enforcement Administration. Back then it was called the Bureau of Narcotics.
Another thing I want to mention going on to VA Watch, on the top of the hour news before I called in, I think it was ABC News. I'm not too sure what, you know, what we're hooked up here with KKZN, but I believe it was ABC. They said that there was a hearing, and a father of a Iraqi GI who'd come back. He said the kid was glazed stare and always looking for insurgents, and he committed suicide on Thanksgiving. And then the news announcer said some huge number, 165, 650 weekly commit suicide.
Right. Yeah, that's total vets, but a disproportionate percentage of those are Iraq war vets. I don't have the number right in front of me right now. Larry has shared that with us in the past.
And, it was horrendous.
And yeah, it truly is. This is and Brian, thanks for the call. This is, you know, back during the Vietnam War, there was this phrase that was very prevalent: "The war comes home," and we're seeing that again, and all the more the tragedy. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to do an update basically on the Tag Your It thing, showing how people can do a lot, because we all have to do a lot more right now.
Indeed.
Right now, I just put up a new website. I'm working with the Kucinich campaign more, and there's a website, Colorado for Kucinich, .org. You can see a video I did there that's also on YouTube.
Cool.
But that stuff, tonight, Elizabeth Kucinich is here in Denver, and you can find the information about that event there.
Okay.
But it's amazing how quickly one can get involved. You know, my video is going to be shown at the thing tonight.
That's great.
And it's just so easy again. Every one of us can do a lot very quickly, and it's just not hard.
Yep. Get out there and get active. Good on you, Jeff.
Go to ColoradoForKucinich.org.
There you go. Okay, Colorado for Kucinich. Thank you. And, in fact, Dennis Kucinich is the last one standing among the humans in the 620kpoj.com progressive straw poll. Well, it's actually just we had the Republicans, independents, and Democrats, and now it's down to Dennis versus my cat Higgins. So you can see how that's shaking out at 620kpoj.com. Chris in Danville. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. With with all the stuff we see going on, scandals with the Republicans in bathrooms and whatnot, and, you know, the lying about the war and all the stuff that's going on, it seems like I get the sense that the Conservative Party and the neocons, they're spending political capital a lot. I mean, disproportionately faster than they're earning it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I just want to ask you, what do you think? How long do you think this is sustainable? I mean, how long do you think they can keep doing this? And where do you see them? And like, in 10 years, what do you think their party's going to do?
I would suggest, Chris, that probably, they started this stuff really big time in the mid 60s through the late 70s of pushing their whole agenda of, it's all about individual initiative, which is code words for no Social Security, no unemployment insurance, no national health care program. If you're going to be dependent on anybody for any of these things that are larger than you are, it's going to be a private for-profit corporation, presumably run by a Republican, who's going to make a big salary. And I would say probably by the mid 80s, most Americans were starting to figure out that it doesn't work, that laissez-faire, just, absolutely hands-off capitalism, brings us the Gilded Age, brings us the robber barons, and brings us massive poverty, and it dramatically increases poverty, and wipes out the middle class, and raises the people at the very top. And the GOP reinvented itself at that point. They reinvented themselves away from being the party of the fat cats. I mean, the old, you see these old political cartoons from the 1920s or from the late 19th century, and the Republicans were always characterized as a very, very heavy guy in a three-piece suit with a cigar, you know, a man, typically a balding man, you know, an older man, you know, the classic fat cat, as it were, politician. And increasingly now, in part because Lyndon Johnson gave away the racist vote in the South by signing civil rights legislation in the 1960s, And Nixon said, oh, yeah, well, we'll pick up those races. Increasingly, the Republicans have had to make their case based on racial issues, gender issues, and religious issues. And now with 9/11, they've added to that fear and xenophobia issues. But it's all ultimately always about be afraid. That's what they're all about, is they're telling everybody that they need to be afraid. They're saying that we should be afraid of minorities. They're saying that we should be afraid of women. They're saying that we should be afraid of Muslims. They're saying that we should be afraid of other countries. You know, it's ultimately, it all boils down to fear. That's the only thing they have to sell. And so, in answer to your question, how much political capital do the cons have left? It's going to depend on whether or not they're able to generate a new be afraid event for us before the next election. That's the thing that we all need to be watching for, and that's the thing that I hope the Democratic Party is planning for, is what happens if there is another, you know, God forbid, another 9/11 or something like it between now and the election. And the Democrats have to position themselves to say, you know, when the last major terrorist event in the United States, when Tim McVeigh blew up the federal building, the McMurray Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Bill Clinton dealt with it the right way. He pulled the country together. He tracked the guy down and he put him in prison. He declared him a psychopathic criminal, whereas Bush did it the wrong way. When we got attacked, instead of tracking the guy down, he let the guy go free. In fact, he let him go free on several occasions. Instead of bringing him to justice when bin Laden, assuming that it was bin Laden behind it, when bin Laden was offered to us by the Taliban, he said no. You know, we're going to blow you up instead. And now we're occupying two countries in the Middle East. One where, of course, we wanted to put a gas pipeline. The other where we want to take their oil. And, gee, how all that's... But the bottom line is, if there is another event like this, then the Republicans will have some fear to sell. And then they will have a chance in the election. And I really hope the Democrats are ready for that. Because... A, I wouldn't put anything past these guys from false flag operations on down, and B, certainly they're opportunists. You know, it's however you take this thing apart, however you spin it, however you look at it, it's a very, very, very critical time. 404 days, by the way, 9 hours, 8 minutes, and 7 seconds from now, George W. Bush will leave office voluntarily. That's assuming that there's no impeachment between now and then, which is increasingly unlikely day by day, but you never know. You know, the crimes of this administration being exposed, Henry Waxman out there, everybody looking at him, you never know. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com. You want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com, our blog, 45 minutes past the hour.
Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Yeah, how about some truth? Like, let's see, the National Review just endorsed Mitt Romney. And guess who Mitt Romney gave $10,000 to back in March? If you guessed the National Review, you guessed right. See, in Republican land, everything's for sale. Josh in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Josh, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I'd like to let your listeners know about an organization called LEAP, who stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Mm-hmm. And it's a group of active and retired law enforcement officers who have seen firsthand that the war on drugs is doing more harm than good, and they're trying to stop it by getting an authoritative voice out there.
That's great, Josh. Is there a website for this that's easily found?
I don't know. I think it's leap.org, but it's L-E-A-P.
Great. Law enforcement against prohibition.
Jeff, I think it was started by Norm Stamper, who is the used to be the chief of police for Seattle.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. Josh, thank you very much. I appreciate the information. Jeff in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Jeff.
Yeah, Tom, you were talking about, you know, the old image of the Republican being those fat white cats and white fat cats and everything else.
Right.
I mean, does anybody remember during the Reagan administration how incredibly mean-spirited that administration was?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Reagan made the joke about the poverty. You know, somebody asked him once, you know, how is the war on poverty going? And he said, exactly. The poor lost.
I mean, but, you know, when they yanked funding for mental health services.
Yeah, and all of a sudden we had homeless people in America. We didn't have homeless people on the streets before Reagan, you know, since the Great Depression.
And how about this? I mean, like, you know, I was raised as a Republican, you know, and just my parents were, you know, and it wasn't until, like, 84, about when I finally just went, this is not the same Republican Party. This is just plain mean.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, started thinking for myself. But, you know, I remember one of the big ones was when all of a sudden they said, okay, fine. Let's cut farm subsidies. They changed the rules on these farmers. All of a sudden, gave them no chance to adjust or anything like that. We had farmers who were working hard all their lives, playing by the rules, and they lost their farms.
Yeah, yeah.
And that to me was just unconscionable.
Right, and it rippled right across the United States in the 1980s, and it was again a direct consequence of Reagan and the deregulation and the basically his saying we're no longer going to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act. Instead, we're going to let big corporations get even bigger. We're going to let them, you know, basically drive these small farmers out of business. And now, you know, I grew up in Michigan, a lot, which is a very rural state, and a lot of farming goes on in Michigan, and people that I know. I mean, friends of mine who grew up on the farm, their families are still on the farm. They no longer own the farm. They are essentially tenant farmers. They work on land that is now owned by one of two or three major corporations. Karen in Sacramento, California. Hey, Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. You're talking about farming, and I just wanted to ask your opinion on the farm bill that's before the Senate. And if any of your listeners would go to TomHarkin.com, he is asking for people to sign his petition to support him on it.
Yeah, Tom Harkin is trying to do some good stuff with the farm bill. My personal opinion is that it's a mixed bag. You know, there's and frankly, I'd like to see a little less emphasis on ethanol subsidies via corn and more emphasis on biofuels of other varieties, but. You know, bottom line, I don't think it's a terrible piece of legislation.
So it's kind of like we'll have to take what we can get for now.
For the moment, yeah. You know, it's the problem is you've got the Republicans in the Senate capable of blowing up legislation, and you got a president who's certainly willing to veto things. You know, so you know, there is some good legislation getting through, but most of it is mediocre because of the influence of all these Republicans. All the more the reason why we have to get a Democrat in the White House and solidify, get at least 60 Democratic votes in the United States Senate. Karen, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along here. Scott in Oxford, Michigan. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm just great. What's up?
Cool. Hey, I've been listening to you for a long time, and, you know, you're probably one of the most brilliant guys on the radio. What I wanted to talk about was your assertion about the Republicans using a Be Very Afraid event.
Right.
If that happens before the election, it's probably likely that the elections won't happen, and Bush will declare his martial law that he drummed up in.
See, I don't think he'll have to, and I don't think he would get away with it. I really don't. You know, I think that there are enough Republicans, enough, you know, like my dad kind of Republicans, you know, the old Eisenhower Republicans, the ones who remember when the Republican Party actually had some scruples. I think there's enough of them out there that are going to push back, and in fact, they're already pushing back, that he couldn't get away with it.
I think a lot of people are finally seeing through the whole facade.
Yeah.
That the I don't know what you would call this group of Republicans.
Well, that's my point, and that's why my concern is that they're going to drum up something new for us to be afraid of, because it's always been selling fear of race, selling fear of gender, selling fear of terror, selling fear of others, selling fear of immigrants. They're all about fear. It's the only thing they've got, because they can't say what they're for, because what they're for is making rich people richer and wiping out the middle class so that we're not this troublesome rabble as the first conservative president of the United States, John Adams, referred to the average person. Thanks a lot for the call. Raymond in Van Nuys, California. Hey, Raven.
No, I pay taxes, and they're privatizing the highways, so I have to pay to get on them. They're privatizing the schools, so I have to, my taxes built them, and so I have to pay to go to school. They're privatizing the army and the prisons. And why aren't these Democratic candidates going out there? They're going to put a stop to this. And plus the fact they come out and say they're going to lower the taxes for the middle class rather than saying we're going to raise taxes.
Raymond, you're spot on. You know where it all began? It all began in the Supreme Court in the 1970s. I think it was 76, the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, where the Supreme Court in that case, in the Buckley case, came out and said money equals speech. The First Amendment protects speech, and so big money can have access to the political arena, and you can't stop it. You can't regulate it. You can't control it. And what we have ended up with is democracy of, by, and for the wealthy and the powerful rather than democracy of, by, and for we the people. And until the Supreme Court revisits Buckley, or until some serious legislation is passed that would roll back Buckley, although Buckley was placed in a constitutional frame, so I'm not sure how you would do that without amending the Constitution. Until we change the composition of the Supreme Court, this is the problem we're going to have, and until we have serious campaign finance reform. And by the way, this composition of the Supreme Court will change over the next 4 to 8 years, and it's, again, going to depend on who's the president, making it all the more important to get out there and get active. Coming up tomorrow, Richard Ralston and I will be talking about health care, mandatory health care, Naomi Klein, Christy Harvey, the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.